Warm welcome to you all. Thank you very much for coming to the IPE annual lecture. I'm absolutely delighted to welcome Wesley Wiedmeyer. He's going to talk to us on both sides now, paradigms, power, psychology and pragmatism at the midpoint of crisis. By way of an introduction, I'm not going to go on for long because we're going to be a little bit limited in time today. But by way of an introduction, Wes is an associate professor at Griffith University in Brisbane, Australia, so he's come a long way to be with us. And he is, as well, among other things, the lead editor of a leading IPE journal called the Review of International Political Economy. He is very highly regarded, widely published in IPE and IR, and certainly, from my perspective, I think his work has really contributed significantly into insights in how we understand the power of ideas, as well as how we can understand meanings of crises and how we sort of deal with ideas during crises. Which brings us, I think, pretty perfectly onto Wes's talk. He's going to talk for about 35 minutes, and then we'll have about 30 minutes or so for Q&A afterwards. But for reasons beyond Wes's control, we have to leave at 6:15 to dash to the airport. So I'm going to definitely make sure we finish at 6:15, if that's okay with you guys. So over to you, Wes.
Thank you. Thanks for that gracious, great flattering introduction, Caroline. And thank you all for coming. I love Warwick. I've been coming here for years. The draft of my first book was crafted at a WMD workshop, the Warwick Manuscript Development, with James Brassett was there, and Len Seabrook, and so I've been coming here for years, and it's great to keep coming and meeting everyone. What I want to talk about tonight is I want to begin on kind of a meta note. And talk about the importance of theory and why theory is so important to keep us sensitive in IPE, and there's some resistance to that in recent years. And then use some of the comments about theory as a jumping off into discussions of ideas and the ways in which there are some lacunae or gaps in constructivist ideas, constructivist theories in particular, missing a sense of the role of social psychology and all the ways in which we don't make efficient use of information and the ways in which we're flawed and markets are flawed. And then apply that framework to make sense of the rise and demise of neoliberalism, and then talk very briefly about Trump and the current crisis, and that we're kind of the midpoint of crisis, historically speaking. So all hope is not lost. So just to go in and talk, probably these slides are way too cluttered, and I apologize for that. But you know, especially since we have such a large graduate student cohort today, as the editor of Right, one thing I get a sense of sometimes is that you know there are kind of cycles and waves in IPE debates. And the 1990s were a high watermark for theory. And Warwick students have a real appreciation for theory, so I'm probably talking a little bit to the converted. But there was a sense in the 90s that the theoretical debates were the commanding heights of the literature. And as you moved into the aughties, as you moved into the 2000s, there was a sense that we've had enough theory. We've gotten drunk on theory. We need to start doing research, right? And I think the high water of that view is the David Lake piece on open economy politics, where he lays out a kind of standard pluralist agenda and says, okay, this is the framework, well, let's just get on with it, right? And to me that's, I want to make the case for kind of a continued focus on theory by going back to the beginning of the paradigm wars, right? I always think of Star Wars. You fought in the Clone Wars, I fought in the paradigm wars, right? What was really at stake, you know? And, the paradigm wars mattered because across security and across IPE, the theories didn't let us make sense of reality in any kind of complete way. What theory did in the standard Waltzian triptych view was to promote explanation, kind of backwards looking, apply it to predict, a kind of pattern recognition way, what's going to happen, and then at the height of hubris, control things based on that. I mean, really naive, right? A naive kind of positivism. And in a Dewey and Wordian pragmatic sense, that overlooks the way in which we also use theory to create. The theory is constitutive, okay? That our theories about how the international political economy works, how the international system works, can feed back on people's understandings, right? If markets think that deficits
will drive down the currency. They may drive down the currency, right? But if markets think in Keynesian terms that deficits will promote growth, they may drive up the currency, right? There's no a priori basis for saying one or the other is going to happen outside some sense of what people are thinking. And more importantly, in the 1990s, there were all these orthodoxies. And in grad school, I think people like Mark Blythe and myself and Len and, you know, our whole mafia, we couldn't break through what the professors were insisting on. So Alex Wentz, Anarchy is What States Make of It, is really important in international relations debates because it says the security dilemma is not inevitable. Right? The security dilemma was materially, exogenously given things. And for all the flaws people find in Wentz, that was a huge thing to say, wait, you can still have a particular incentive to a balance of power, but if the identities are different, states may still form security communities. It's not inevitable, but it's possible, right? And this notion that we need to look into the meanings of these dilemmas and kind of problematize these ostensible trade-offs, you can see it in IPE. Constructivism is to some degree, you know, it's a social theory, it's old wine in new bottles. You can go back to discussions of the Phillips curve in the early 1960s. John Kenneth Galbraith, you know, when people talked about an inevitable trade-off between inflation and unemployment, right? If unemployment goes down to 2 or 3%, inflation's got to go through the roof, according to the Phillips curve. And Galbraith always said, no, it could, but if you can work with people who have market power, if you have societal cooperation, it doesn't. So it's the same social argument behind Wendt's critique of the security dilemma. They're just saying that incentives don't speak for themselves. And, you know, Ben Clift and I have each argued and taken on the notion of the impossible trinity. The impossible trinity isn't inevitable, right? States can cooperate to fix expectations. It's not saying these things are inevitable, but, you know, theory matters because if you're not pushing against open economy politics or neorealists who are making their theoretical claims, it's not just about explanations. Backwards looking, you know, kind of extrapolating the future prediction and possibilities, you're blinding yourself to possibilities. The theory's constitutive. So that's why theory really matters. Now, maybe the paradigm wars got a little stale. I'll grant you that, you know, and there could be room for opening up the discussion and debate. And so there's theoretical limits, right, specifically to constructivism. Cooperative possibilities are not inevitable, they can vary. Okay, so as a social fact, it may be that states don't cooperate. As a social fact, you may not be able to get accord between capital and labor. Okay, but you need to have ongoing theoretical debate to create a sense of awareness of these ongoing possibilities. And why we still need them, there's a lack of sense, I think, in the paradigm wars to the extent that all the paradigms are still rationalist. They all tend to assume that we still make efficient use of all available information, right? So there's a sense that, you know, to put it in Wendt's term, anarchy is what states make of it, that we can really make sense of things in an intelligible way. If you're talking about Fenimore sinking, talking about norms, there's a sense that we know what the norms are, right? But our understandings, you know, may give rise, we may develop understandings that give rise to new unanticipated behaviors, right? There may be contradictory understandings we have. We may lose track of old information. There can be all these ways in which, you know, the constructed understandings from one period are a source of instability in the next period. And I think, you know, the paradigmatic frameworks, in particular to the extent that they're rationalist, there's an opportunity to make a social psychological critique, okay? And kind of look at the ways in which we don't know what we want. Our ideas are contradictory. Our preferences are not consistent, right? That's what rationalists assume. Rationalists assume that interests, that ideas, preferences are consistent, and we make use of information, efficient use of information in evaluating them. So just where constructivism left off. We all know these quotes. These are famous, right? Keynes' famous quote, the ideas of economists and political philosophers are more powerful than is commonly understood. Vested interests are less important than ideas. Wendt, interests are beliefs about how to meet needs. Onuf, we construct worlds we don't know in a world we do not. And because culture matters, we've got Joni Mitchell in there from both sides now, right? It's life illusions, I recall. I really don't know life at all, which is Onuf, right? We construct worlds we know in a world we don't, okay?
But what have we forgotten, right? There's a sense, you know, constructivists look at Keynes, that ideas stabilize our interests, but what have constructivists forgotten? They've forgotten animal spirits, okay? They've looked at conventions, and I think there's a tendency to treat conventions as a little bit too coherent. So this is from Keynes' follow-up to the general theory. The book, he wrote an article for the Quarterly Journal of Economics called The General Theory of Employment, and he emphasized the psychological aspects of the general theory much more in this article. Okay, now, a practical theory of the future based on conventions, a certain marked characteristics, so flimsy a foundation, it is subject to sudden and violent changes, new fears and hopes will without warning take charge of human conduct. All these pretty polite techniques made for a well-paneled boardroom and a nicely regulated market are able to collapse 2008, right? Lehman Brothers, okay? And this isn't in a lot of constructivism. When crises hit, when these panics hit, moreover, we often don't respond by throwing things open for debate, right? John Kenneth Galbraith, contemporary of Keynes, one of his more famous quotes, faced with a choice between changing one's mind and proving there's no need to do so, almost everyone gets busy on the proof. Okay, so people are really able to kind of rationalize why we don't need to change our ideas when there's a crisis. In fact, if only you'd listened to me, we wouldn't have had the crisis. That's John Taylor, right, who came up with the Taylor Rule, who was going to be one of the front runners for the Federal Reserve Chair. That was just announced. He lost out, right? But he's written a series of books. If only they'd listened to me, is the underlying theme, right? So, you know, people don't always, you know, focus on don't always see crises necessitating change. They see them as necessitating reinforcing their commitment to ideas. So, you know, there's a rationalist problem through all, a kind of rationalist model that shapes all of the main paradigms, right? Realists, hegemonic stability, wars and crises enable state great powers to shape self-reinforcing orders, liberalism, second image reversed, open economy politics, crises shape stabilizing coalitions, constructivism, norm entrepreneurs shape norm cascades, self-reinforcing orders, historical institutionalists, that's their whole thing, right? That the crisis comes and it creates this kind of self-reinforcing thing. And we're missing a lot there, okay? Because again, as I suggested before, what if we don't make efficient use of information? What if our preferences are not consistent? Okay, then we overrate the scope for self-reinforcing stability. All right, there's no reason to think set it and forget it, historical institutionalist models work. We underrate the potential for sustained instability. We don't explain crises, right? Crises are the exogenous shock. It's the deus ex machina that drives so many of these accounts, but they're not explained. I love Mark Blyth, he's fantastic. But in great transformations, as Monty Python used to do, at the end of the story, there's a crisis, a new change, and he drops the cow. There's no explanation for the next crisis. He just picks up with the inflation crisis, right? It's a great book, but you have to explain, where does the instability come from? You know, how does the solution to the last crisis in some ways cause the next crisis or contribute to the explanation for the next crisis? And I'm not, you know, these kinds of ideas have been bubbling up in debate. Neoclassical realists like Jennifer Mixon and Randy Schweller have talked about misplaced certainty. Constructivists like Michael Barnett and Martha Fenimore have talked about policy pathologies. Vivian Schmidt, who was here a few years ago, highlights the tensions between different types of ideas. Our ideas conflict with one another. Practice theory itself says all of these coherent ideas that constructivists like myself describe. Here's Friedman's idea. Here's Keynes' idea. Practice theorists would say, no, it's never that clear. It's always messy and embodied and intuitive and rough, right? So I'll cop to being a little bit too cognitive. And the advantage of a social psychological approach, which builds on these insights, is to highlight the destabilizing effects, again, of shared precognitive ideas. Now, how do you get at it? There's lots of ways to get at social psychological dynamics, right? The kind of shared but flawed assumptions that we have that we use to kind of get through the day. I like the work of Daniel Kahneman. And Daniel Kahneman's great because he's social psychological and he situates ideas in time. So to the extent that constructivists often have a problem with, and all approaches do, but have a problem with the under what conditions question, right? When is one type of idea likely to predominate over another? Kahneman talks about how we have two types of thinking, two systems, system one and two, fast and slow thinking. And it's very intuitive, right?
that when we, something unexpected happens, we don't ask ourselves, what do we think? We ask ourselves, how do I feel, right? And then we slow down, right? Then we slow down and maybe we get cognitive and we refine and we ask, what does it mean? And this is, we've got Anna Freud on the first slide. In a lot of ways, Kahneman has cleaned up social psychoanalysis. He's cleaned up Freudianism without all the kind of crazy baggage that Freud came up with. Freud's contribution is, what's the unconscious, right? What shapes us? Why do we do things? And we often do things for reasons that we don't completely understand. But he says it's about the Oedipal complex, right? He says it's about women wanting to be men, right? Well, you don't have to go there, right? You can just go thinking fast and slow, right? And so Kahneman draws on neuroscience, the amygdala, right? The amygdala, our center of emotional memory, lights up before our prefrontal cortexes and things like that. So, there's lots of insights there. So we think fast and then we think slow. And I'm already seeing that I'm running slow, I'm running out of time. Kind of fast thinking heuristics in the context of the construction of a political order, a lot of constructivists say, well, we have ideas. Ideas reduce uncertainty, kind of cognitive sense and give us a script. But before you get that cognitive idea, Kahneman suggests you actually ask yourself, how do I feel? And there's some great kind of experimental stuff that's come out on this. After 9/11 in the States, for example, people were asked, you can pay for a life insurance policy against death or a life insurance policy against death in a terrorist attack, right? People would pay more for insurance against death in a terrorist attack, right? Which is crazy because dying includes dying in a terrorist attack, right? So we're in a business school, right? So as an investment decision, there goes the theory of making efficient use of information. But it makes sense because people ask themselves, who can fathom thinking about death and how you're gonna go? But you think, what do I fear? What do I fear most? What do I want to insure against the most? You fear death in a terrorist attack, right? And so that helps explain a lot of American foreign policy, right? This is an IPE lecture, but it gives you some insight as to why people react in the ways they do. And so I want to suggest there's this kind of principled construction, that there's always a kind of value-laden basis. It can relate to, and we'll talk a little bit about the distribution of market power in the overall economy. And these ideas, as Jackie Best says, they're ambiguous. People can project different things onto them. That's a source of appeal. Make America great again, right? Who could argue with that, right? Everyone can look at that and get behind that, right? But then you need policy levers. And so ambiguity is good initially, but then you need some more certainty. You need to reduce uncertainty after you've provided for some ambiguous centralization of understandings. So that's when you get to the slow cognitive heuristics. That's when the policymakers get in there. And this parallels Vivian Schmidt's stuff on communicative versus coordinative rhetorics. And there's lots of approaches that have a family resemblance. I'm not suggesting this is the only way it can be looked at. How do we think about IPE debates in these terms? Okay. I fought in the paradigm wars. So I think in terms of agents and structures. Right? But it's good to think in terms of agents and structures because that's how we cut into so many debates. So for IPE, you look at the ways in which structures and ideas and beliefs can be inconsistent, right? That there's principled beliefs, there's causal beliefs and models, and they don't always add up, right? And you don't try to make them add up. And this, again, comes from Kate Weaver's stuff on hypocrisy, practice theory, Vivian's, etc. I think there's a thing on systemic views, just ignore that, please. I'm sorry, that shouldn't be on there. Then there's inefficient mechanisms, right? And there's a big thing in publishing these days. You come up with a problem and you come up with a mechanism that provides insight into it, right? Anna Freud's notion of defense mechanisms, right? That we try to reduce anxiety, tensions between aspects of our psyche, sometimes blocking out information we can't handle. And repression is the central defense mechanism, right? There's different things that we repress over time. 9/11, nuclear conflict, it's too horrific, right? So we try to kind of abstract away from the emotional context. They talk about doctors with patients on the operating table. You can't look at them as if they're human beings, right? You have to kind of intellectualize things. In terms of interpretation, this calls for a view of interpretation is not a hermeneutics of suspicion, not a hermeneutics where you're trying to figure out what's really going on in the language, how are the interests of capital or labor being masked, right? This is a hermeneutics of expression. So the masters of suspicion are Marx and Freud and Nietzsche, right? You know, the rhetoric is always hiding something. For Dewey and Rorty, you know, language is always expressing things. It's forward-looking. It's giving rise to new possibilities and interests and understandings, like we said back on the first slide. So these things all fit together.
Where's the IP in any of this discussion, right, so far? So I want to suggest there's two kind of important distinct understandings of the economy.
John Kenneth Galbraith, here's the Both Sides Now title, right? The Both Sides Now title comes from Joni Mitchell's famous song, "With the Clouds from Both Sides Now," and John Kenneth Galbraith's bimodal understanding of the economy, the bimodal image of the economy, where part of it is in terms of market power, where firms possess market power, and most importantly, can resist macroeconomic pressures. And then there's the kind of market part of the economy where firms are prey to macroeconomic pressures, right? Where they don't have control over wages, prices, returns, right? And so Galbraith argued, depending on how we think about the economy, right? If we think about it in the more politicized terms of market power, right? Where agents have influence over wages and prices, right? Where firms can be, I mean, he wrote this back in 1978, where you have firms that are too big to fail, right, that won't be permitted to fail, right? In this context, you need regulation. You need wage price guidelines. That's what Galbraith pushed for in the 1970s, right? Because labor unions in the 1970s were too damn powerful. And so Galbraith said you need to provide wage price guidelines to provide a sense of the public interest in private wage price restraint. Today, we have macroprudential regulation, right, which is a similar kind of thing where you have, you know, financial firms taking too much risk, right? There's a concern that this may lead to asset price bubbles. So you try to limit that, right, and directly regulate them without killing the whole economy. For more macroeconomic models, like the Phillips curve, like the Taylor rule, there is no market power in the economy, right? So if you increase interest rates a little, you can decrease investment a little, right? If you raise interest rates, you can slow down the economy and keep wages in check. It's very smooth and continuous, and you can put these things on curves, and it's not political, right? Because people don't even know what's happening. That's the beauty of macroeconomics, right? We just kind of respond to these incentives without thinking. It's taken out of the political value-laden realm, okay?
So what's this got to do with thinking about crises and the neoliberal order?
Well, I suggest a model of the construction of principled foundations for an order, the conversion of that order into a more intellectual model. And what happens when you develop these intellectual models, which, you know, have been refined once market power somewhere else has been broken, is you don't recognize sources of new market power. Okay, so to tell the story of neoliberalism, it was about breaking the power of labor, and then the ideas were refined. Okay, labor was broken. You had the Taylor rule, which provided a guide for fine-tuning monetary policy. And this obscured the mounting market power of finance, which explodes in 2008. So that's the basic story, right, of the construction of an order, conversion, and crisis. And how are we doing on time? We've got five, we said, Caroline, 3, 4, 5?
Okay. So Ronald Reagan, taking the American case, breaking labor in the neoliberal order.
Reagan took inflation and he turned it into a moral problem, okay? If you just make it a macroeconomic problem, right, it's, you know, it's difficult for people to understand. But he famously said in his inaugural address in 1981, I didn't even bother to put it on here because everyone knows it, government's not the solution to the problem, government is the problem. Very basic critique. In 1981, air traffic controllers in the United States went on strike. I don't know how many people know this story. It was illegal for public employees to go on strike. Okay. They were seeking higher wages. Rather than make the issue about inflation and just wages, Reagan made it about the oath they took to the public good. Right? He said that it's in recognition that Congress passed a law forbidding strikes by government employees. Let me read the solemn oath. I am not participating in any strikes against the government of the United States, and I will not do so while an employee of the government or any agency thereof. Right? And he said they were fired. He read letters from striking workers who decided to go back to the job. And these letters would say things like, you know, I tell my kids to obey the law. How can they take me seriously if I don't obey the law? So it's a moral issue, inflation is. And this provides the basis for breaking labor, right?
And you know, there's coordinative stuff that's going on as well, too.
You've not just got the moral force of inveighing against the unions, but you have Paul Volcker, you have the monetary austerity under Thatcher in England as well, where interest rates in the US are raised to the neighborhood of 20%, unemployment goes up to 10%. And you also have the seeds of the new foundation of the neoliberal order, right? Because if you don't have wage earners being a source of demand, where's demand going to come from? It's got to come from wealth. It's got to come from asset price appreciations, okay? So the monetarist experiment lasted for 3 years, okay? From basically October 79 to August 1982. And then the Mexican finance minister came to Donald Reagan, Ronald Reagan's treasury secretary, and he goes into Donald Reagan. Donald Reagan wasn't very smart. I mean, I'm pretty smart in his own way, but he didn't understand finance. And the Mexican finance minister says, Mexico can't pay its debts to the United States Bank. And Donald Reagan said, well, you damn well better. Right? And then the Mexican finance minister goes to Paul Volcker, who's the chairman of the Federal Reserve, who is very smart and who regulates American banks. And it's that old line, if you owe me a dollar, it's your problem. If you owe me $1 million, it's my problem. Right? And so Paul Volcker recognizes, holy cow, if we don't bail out the Mexican economy, we're going to see the American banks go under. Yeah, so it's the first real too big to fail moment. Right? And if you've got unemployment, if you've got financial panic, you've got a depression, right? So you've broken labor, and this is the foundation for rebuilding finance. And Paul Volcker abandoned monetarism, flooded markets with money, cut interest rates, worked through the IMF, et cetera, and you know, that's the end of monetarism.
You still need a way, though, okay? You still need a tool, right?
The great ambiguity of Ronald Reagan and, you know, making inflation is about values and morals is good, but it doesn't give you a way of controlling the economy. And there's a lot of groping towards what we take for granted today.
In February 87, the relationships between, you know, the money supply, there were different measures of the money supply and the price level were always tenuous, especially when you deregulate finance at the same time. In February 87, the Fed announced that it would no longer set targets for M1. In July 93, Alan Greenspan, the chairman of the Federal Reserve at the time, announced he would downgrade M2 as a reliable indicator of financial conditions. And we moved to, okay, what we have now in central banks all over the world, interest rate rules, okay, the causal models, which involve fine-tuning, okay, constantly changing the interest rate. I mean, this is fine-tuning out of Keynes's dreams, right? Every 6 weeks, the American Federal Open Market Committee meets and measures their words, you know, thinks about, you know, moves the, and the words are actually more important than the interest rates often, right? The signal to markets what's going to happen next. And uses a formula like this, which looks at not just the inflation rate, right, but GDP and the GDP gap between GDP and potential GDP. And if the economy's going too slow, you cut interest rates. If the economy's going too fast, you raise them according to these models. And there's different kinds of Taylor rules, right? Okay. And you know, Taylor's pragmatic. Here's Janet Yellen from 1996, who's 6 weeks now before, how long before she's out as Federal Reserve Chair? Right, it's November, so 3 months before she's out. So they've just announced a new Federal Reserve Chair today. The existence, and she's a Democrat, right? So we're in consensus mode here. John Taylor's a Republican, Janet Yellen's a Democrat. The existence of a policy trade-off requires a strategy for managing them. John Taylor of Stanford University has designed a policy rule of thumb that neatly illustrates how a central bank can pursue stabilization policy without losing its focus on the long-term price stability goal. So you can promote full employment and keep prices stable. That's the Phillips curve. Okay, the story is, you know, Ben and I are working on stuff, you know, that monetarism dismantled the Phillips curve. But if you open the newspaper every 6 weeks, you see that there's still fine-tuning going on. And, you know, Greenspan was very pragmatic. He wasn't a hard and fast, rigid, you know, he didn't have an econ PhD. He actually got one in 76 after he'd served as Ford's chair, Jerry Ford's chair of the Council of Economic Advisors.
But they say it's impossible to get his thesis because it's so bad. It's like a national security crisis. But that's his strength. Some people would argue that he's not an economist, that he had some kind of psychological feel for things. And he looked at, you know, kind of worker attitudes and, you know those kinds of concerns, and he kept interest rates low, and you know, it was the leaning and cleaning model that they eventually came to. You know, you lean against inflation during normal times, and then you clean up after financial panics, okay? Ben Bernanke is increasingly technocratic overconfidence, okay? So beholden to these kinds of trade-offs that right before the global financial crisis, he doesn't focus on, you know, traumatic workers anymore. He's fighting the last war. In June 2008, he argues that currently high level of inflation, if it were sustained, that might lead the public to revise up its expectations for longer term inflations in ways that could become embedded in the domestic wage and price setting process. We already knew the financial crisis was, this is after Bear Stearns, so we know things are getting bad. But that mental model, right, repression, not looking at the wider context of what are workers' attitudes, is their financial market power accumulating, right? You've got a model, and it's a kind of iron cage, right? It's a source of inefficiency in policy that obscures the new source of market power. And Barack Obama, for all his brilliance, and you know, kind of his rhetorical brilliance, he didn't do what Reagan did. He was averse to making the global financial crisis an emotional, value-laden crisis. Okay, his argument was Hippocratic oath. Okay? He continued to keep that kind of technocratic mindset. Governments should practice the same principle as doctors: first, do no harm. This was Secretary of Treasury Geithner's line. This was Larry Summers, the chair of the National Economic Council under Obama's line. It was a recurring thing. And if not, I'm not being a snotty prof and saying, oh, if they'd only listen to me, right? It makes sense, because Obama's concern was, look, markets are tanking. If we move in with all the regulations that people want in a fast-thinking sense and impose them, we're just going to spook markets even more, and the economy's not going to recover. So I've got a utilitarian responsibility to help the economy grow again. So I'm not suggesting that Obama, what he did, didn't make sense in a utilitarian terms. It didn't make sense in terms of popular legitimacy, though. You know, that's a concern. And you have this great quote from Tim Geithner in his stress test book. Tim Geithner was Obama's Treasury Secretary. The president once told me he felt uncomfortable playing a populist, like he was wearing clothes that didn't fit. He wasn't going to be a convincing Teddy Roosevelt lambasting the malefactors of great wealth, and the bankers weren't going to impose public sector salaries on themselves and their senior executives, right? So not a populist, right? And, you know, as a result, we're in the land of the uber populist. You know, there were possibilities, you know, for change. There were things like macroprudential regulation, because economists did look and they recognized where banks had market power, and you don't want to kill the whole economy by raising interest rates. You can kind of focus regulation on you know, the incentives to asset price spirals. So wage restraint, executive pay restraint, to the extent that executive pay provides an incentive for firms to take great risks, drive up stock values. There's good kind of, you know, rational justifications for doing that. And it's also very popular, right? There was real anger at the executives and their pay. It also has a constituency in the Federal Reserve, okay? Powell, the new Federal Reserve chair, I don't think he's going to move away from some concern for macroprudential regulation, because central bankers often like these regulations because they take the pressure off of monetary policy to slow the economy down when there's concerns about asset price bubbles or wage price spirals, right? You can say, okay, we're not going to kill the economy. Don't make us be the hatchet men. Use regulation to deal with the kind of core of the problem, okay? So it does have a constituency, macroprudential regulation does in the Federal Reserve. We'll continue below the radar under Trump. Maybe there could be some kind of populist justification for Reagan, but the Democratic Party split. I'm just getting into, you know, cocktail speculations. Okay. So to sum up, okay, what are the conclusions for history? No more end of ideology. Sorry, Bell. No more end of history. Sorry, Fukuyama. This kind of way of social psychological constructivism says no more norm cascades. Okay? Hegemonic stability causes instability from this view, right? Coalitional alignments, they're going to devolve, okay? And this gives us a mechanism in repression and forms of repression for getting at that, okay? So Whigger end of history narratives we should be more skeptical of. In terms of policy, this highlights the limits to pragmatism. Okay, the limits to pragmatism, often at its moments of greatest success. Results don't speak for themselves. JFK used to say, if the economy grows well, people will reward me. Barack Obama said that too. Okay, you don't get rewarded just for results. You have to explain it. Despite Trump, despite Brexit, in terms of policy, if you look at these kinds of dynamics in terms of the rise and decline of the progressive era, the rise and decline of the Keynesian era, we're at the midpoint of crisis. You can argue the Great Depression went from 25 to 45, 20 years. You can argue the Great Inflation went from 65 to 81, right? LBJ doing guns and butter to 81 to Reagan breaking it, right? So the GFC, if you average the midpoint of those two, it's not going to be done until 2025. That's my one concession to, in terms of not being done, but figuring out what it means, what it meant. We're at the midpoint of it. In terms of theory, the argument here is we need to relax rationalism, highlight social psychological dynamics, mechanisms of repression. Again, go look at your Freud, go look at your Anna Freud. There's lots of cool mechanisms in there about how we don't look at things that make us uncomfortable. Gender theory, to the extent that has social psychological, you know, kind of dynamics in it too, there could be interesting interstices between, you know, different types of studies of finance. And more broadly, just recognize that stability causes instability, and these points can still be made, which is why going to the beginning, the paradigm wars are still out there, so you guys can fight in the paradigm wars too, right? Not just for Obi-Wan. So I'll call a break there, and a little bit longer than maybe would have liked, but thank you all.
Thanks, Wes. This is really interesting. Can I ask you a background question?
Sure.
Well, one of the interesting things is that there are a lot of economists here in your talk. The first slide, the subtitle, have a whole list of economists. But they're interesting, aren't they? Here we go.
Sorry.
A few economists, anyway. But they're not the sorts of economists who get to act in the name of what economics is, as it's taught today. I want to ask you just for a few reflections about the relationship between IPE and economics. It looks as though it could be just about anything or everything, depending on what sort of economist that you want to pin your colours to. Because there are, aren't there, significant movements within IPE that want to get closer to a type of economics that doesn't reflect these people, that actually reflects much more what's on the board behind you. There's a certain irony here, but given the talk against the backdrop of a blackboard full of mathematical equations, I'm not sure. I might know what's going on in those, but no, let's not go there. So can you tell us just a bit more about IPE more broadly and its relationship to economics? Is it in danger of being taken over by those people that Mark Blythe would always call second-rate economists, those people that do perhaps a very simplistic account of mathematical economics, whereas the people that you're interested in, they have a very different view of what the relationship between the individual and the economy is. And because of that, they have a very different view of what economics should be.
Are you
okay
if I just take the second question?
Thanks very much for that. So my question is, you've looked at it very much through a sort of Western lens of economics. What does President Xi's socialism with Chinese characteristics, or his new era for economic globalization, add to your debate?
Sure.
Too nice, easy question.
You're right. I mean, you know, this is political economy almost more, right? I mean, these, you know, John Maynard Keynes is political economy. John Kenneth Galbraith, public intellectual, you know, at a level, you know, beyond, you know, in many ways, the realm of any economist, even the most famous economist today. Joan Robinson, I guess I was coming to the UK and giving a talk, and you know, she followed Galbraith as the president of the American Economic Association, I think it was, back in the 70s, so that just seemed appropriate to me. In terms of the debate, though, there still are economists who, I think they do, there are public figures, maybe not at the level of a Galbraith or a Keynes, but, you know, Akerlof and Shiller, you know, people know them. You know, they're on the financial networks, and they as business economists, we're in a business school, business economists are often more cognizant of the existence of market power, right? Because people in business actually want to seize that market power and get the bottlenecks and wrestle the wealth from them in a way that, you know, classical economists say, well, there are no profits, right? You know, so there is a realistic side to economics, which recognizes, and the new Keynesians, you know, the Krugmans, you know, of the world do kind of recognize that, and they're in there in debate. And you have your Galbraiths, you have your Friedmans, you know, who are public intellectuals. I can see that there's no one at that level yet, but there's the possibility there of someone taking those high-level understandings that Friedman and Galbraith engaged of, is there a uniquely public good, or is there, you know, no such thing as society, as, you know, Thatcher said and as, you know, Friedman evokes. There's nothing that precludes someone from, as we continue on in this debate over at the midpoint of crisis, from playing that public intellectual role. And certainly if you're going to find a positive spin on populism, I think it would have to come from something like that. But in a way, I don't have an answer to the empirical kind of side of the question, that these are all kind of economists from the past, because the debate is still kind of ongoing. I mean, you can point to Piketty or someone like that who's played a kind of quasi-public role, I suppose. But there's always going to be discussions of, is there a uniquely public good, or are we all just private actors? Is there a macro, is there a micro? And I think someone's going to engage that. So, and there's particulates of that floating out there. So, in terms of China, what does China want? That's a great case for social psychological, because all my Chinese colleagues, you know, when people say China wants this, they raise their hand and they say, who is China? You know, it may be Xi, but there's other people arguing with him, and China's actually, when I'm arguing with materialists, is one of my examples for, oh, you think interests are self-evident, well, does China want a strong currency or a weak currency? Read that off the balance of power to me, right? Do they want to replace the dollar? Because if they do and they make their currency strong, there goes their trade surpluses, right? It's just not self-evident. So I'm certainly no expert on China, but my colleagues from China, you know, Steve Bell, who, you know, has written a big book on the People's Bank of China, you get a sense that, you know, they don't know what they want. And, you know, you've got Xi talking about China as kind of taking over the liberal world and sticking up for free trade, which is, you know, not something to be taken seriously if you actually look at Chinese policies. So there's a lot of kind of principled professions that are belied by the policies and, you know, are at odds in kind of interesting ways. And so I think the constructivist thing is try to look at how those things are being grappled with. So Xi may know what he wants, but I don't think China knows what it wants, you know, and the social psychological perspective might provide some insight.
So I have one question from Anita. I'll take that.
Thanks, that's really interesting. So I got really, really interested in when you started the story about Reagan and the air traffic controllers, which I knew nothing about, and the sort of appeal to a populist, emotional, nationalist kind of narrative in order to justify a course of action. And then I was quite struck by the way in which you talk about characters like Bernanke and Obama as these kind of very technocratic people. And I was struck by the way in which you kind of associate a moral positioning with the Reagan point of view. And I wondered, you know, what is the morality at play within the kind of technocratic perspective? So you could say, for example, Obama wanted to do the right thing, and for him that meant not pandering to the crowds. It meant, you know, being a moral person because you stuck to the technocratic line about what's right. So, you know, my kind of my question is, you know, what's the role of emotions, of affect, morality in both of these different positionings? And then I suppose, and this might be me really misinterpreting what you're saying in your talk, I suppose then the question is, which is worse, right? Who's got on the kind of bigger social, psychological blinkers when it comes to actually understanding the causes of crisis and what is to be done?
Yeah, yeah.
Sorry,
can I
take them
again?
Sure. Is that okay?
That's absolutely okay. Yeah, so it's more of a, you know, I'm going to sort of try to get the Jedi and the paradigm war back. Because, I mean, you talked about it. I thought it was really interesting, actually. It reminded me a lot of your sort of Millennium piece from 2010, where you sort of explored a lot of these issues, and it was really interesting in that sense. So I'm looking forward to sort of seeing, is this going to be in print?
It's a book. It's a book called Economic Ideas in Political Time.
I need to still get down to reading that. But in any case, it was very, what struck me was that, you know, by relying, or by drawing on people like Kahneman and I guess Kahneman is often associated with Tversky and you know, the idea of prospect theory, right? Which is sort of a form of bounded rationality. And I was wondering, you know, because, you know, in a sense you're trying to move away, I think, you know, you're sort of trying to give a constructivist social psychological perspective. I was wondering how you would differentiate your perspective from that of bounded rationality.
Cool. Yeah. Cool. All right, well, hey, Juanita, I mean, that's spot on, and thank you for that. What was the first part of your question again? I'm sorry, I'm old.
Yeah, the kind of morality.
Oh, the morality, yeah. Well, my cop there, my cheap cop is to say that John Stuart Mill is an ethicist isn't talking about ethics, right? That utilitarianism isn't an ethical point of view, to kind of make it technocratic. But it's utilitarianism isn't really a kind of emotionally laden kind of ethical perspective, right? It's throw the baby out of the carriage to the wolves, the greatest good for the greatest number, right? That kind of thing.
But it's still about the good.
It's still about the
moral claim.
This is where, you know, it's getting into what is kind of moral. It doesn't have that kind of emotional hue to it, right? So to the extent that there's a, you know, that moral arguments are emotional, it's not that. But it's kind of an assertion on my part, so I grant you on that. In terms of who's got the bigger blinkers, Kahneman argues, you know, that we need, and I think we all go along with this, you need both, right? You need emotional intelligence, and you need, you know, kind of cognitive refinement. You can't just, you know, as academics, we tend to be partisan to the cognitive thing, and tend to view emotions, especially in an age of Trump, right? That the emotional stuff is the Tea Party and the Trumpers, and why can't they just figure out, you know, that they're completely wrong? Yeah, so we tend to view ourselves, I think, as, you know, resisting emotion. But you really need both, right? And you need a sense of values to tell you how to use your tools and things like that. What was the second one?
That was it.
Okay. All right. I'm playing jet lag. Whenever I get anything wrong on this trip, I just blame jet lag. Okay. But you can also look in past context. I guess the last thing I was thinking, there's one more thing I would say. In the book, I talk about Teddy Roosevelt, who's generally seen as a good guy, right, who made emotional arguments on behalf of the public good, right? And Woodrow Wilson and his policymakers are much more technocratic. Franklin Roosevelt, you know, who used emotions, you know, talked about the money changers in the temple, right? Very biblical imagery, right? And then it's the Kennedy, you know, Democratic new economists who are doing the Phillips curve, very similar to the Taylor rule. So it's these things can, you know, it can be Republicans who are emotional, it can be Democrats who are emotional, it can be Republicans who are technocratic, it's Democrats who are technocratic. So it's, you know, you can see either excess in either part of the party, and it can't be reduced. Not that you're saying to reduce it to open economy politics, but, you know, the blinkers are in from another perspective. On bounded rationality, I think, is still rationalist, because it says there's like a transaction cost, I'll continue with my prevailing heuristic, mm-hmm. until it becomes so costly that I'll then start to reconsider all my assumptions, right? Whereas when you're Kahneman or when you're psychological, you just say, no, I just blank this stuff out. There's something kind of emotional in there that leads me to view things a certain way, that it's not a rational kind of thing. it's, you know, and this is again when you get to kind of gender theory and things like that, where it's very hard to come up with a rationale for a kind of gender bias, right? It's just, you know, we see gender, right? You know, we see it and we react to it, and you can't put that in. Well, I mean, these kinds of things, these social psychological dynamics are coming from the same kind of emotional place. I'm not saying it's a gender theory of finance, but there's no, you know, if you respond to a particular vision of the public good, you know, to Reagan's treatment of government or unions or, you know, corporations or whatever, it's often just precognitive, you know, through these kind of like deeper kind of understanding. So that's where I think it's not the same as this, the thinking fast and slow thing, and that's where it's, I've got it tied into Freud and, you know, the psychoanalysts. It's unconscious stuff, we just don't have access to it, and we'll keep doing it well past the point of diminishing returns.
So we'll take your question, and I'm going to abuse my position and ask a quick question as well. So, yes.
Oh, okay. Thank you so much for your presentation. This might be speculative at this point, but I was wondering, it looks like there's a lot of promise in highlighting a social psychological constructivist model, but at the same time, do you see any dangers in that, it's not new. There are some scholars who are also highlighting complexities and ambiguities and uncertainties, and trying to, with that recognition, also co-opting it to a certain extent. And when the technocratic emphasis doesn't seem to be going away, and there seems to be even more more emphasis on these kinds of solutions, that when you try to bring in psychological dimensions, it kind of gets lost in a black box, and then there might be dangers where in the future people might say that, well, we didn't have the tools to explain this, we didn't really understand. So do you see these sorts of dangers, or is that something that's sort of...
What time be a demagogue? I mean, the non-demagogue, right? Because I'm at Warwick, I don't see them, right? Because these are the discussions that you guys, you're the bright graduate students, right? Where this is why you need to keep refining the theories, right? It's, you know, presidents say, I trust the wisdom of the American people, right? I'm saying, everyone here is so brilliant, right? I think Donald Trump does that too. You're a brilliant, good-looking group of people. You know, but these theories, I mean, one of the meta-argument, right, is just when you think you figured things out, I mean, this is the Goodhart's Law, right? You know, I mean, you figure everything out and, you know, you use an indicator to guide policy, and what is it, Ben? I always mangle Goodhart's Law. And you use an indicator as a rule when it's not working the way.
Yeah, that's exactly that.
Jet lag, again, on jet lag. But the point is that, you know, I mean, you have to keep adjusting the theories. You have to keep kind of having these debates, and there's always a framework in it that has to be adjusted. We don't judge theories against reality. We judge theories against other theories, right? So if there's something that's being missed here, I'm fine with that. That doesn't really bother me. I think it's, it shines light on 100 years of finance, I'd argue. And the other thing that we rely on theories for is, again, you said on the first slide, it's not just about explaining the backwards-looking sense. It's about, is it relevant to the time, you know, the contemporary problems? And, you know, in a world of Brexit, in the world of Trump, I think a psychological focus kind of just speaks to our current time. You know, we're in a time of you know, great kind of partisan passions. So even if, you know, I had one prof who was like, you want your theory to explain 75% of things, you know, and if constructivism explains 75% and neorealism explains 85%, well, then constructivism isn't as good, right? But to me, it's, you know, it's also theories about, you know, how we collectively understand realities and see opportunities and provide better insight. So I think, again, that this is just me, you know, my subjective view, a social psychological in a world of Brexit and Trump and populism, has much more merit than it did, say, in the 1990s, you know, when everything's kind of cooking along and, you know, it's that kind of Clinton, Blair, third way, you know, politics as administration. You know, so that would be my case for it. Not just does it explain more than the other, I think it does. The theory is not about explaining a reality, it's about, is it a tool that helps us make sense of things going forward as well? And then to come back to my demagoguery, you're going to come up with something better in 10 years.
Just one on the, if you like, the slightly more boring methods question in terms of what does a social psychological approach require of you methodologically to get at the fast thinking stroke the slow thinking, and kind of what are the techniques you used in preparing the book to kind of access those thoughts going on in the minds of the people you're interested in?
I think it's recognizing that the categories don't have to add up. You know, it's recognizing that these things can be messy. It's trying to find the ways in which value-laden ideas fit the causal models, and then kind of looking and seeing, well, when does there start to be some separation, right? When is there separation between the causal models and what seems to be going on in the wider world? You know, Bernanke, 2008, for example. But I think it's just, a lot of us as, I'm an American grad student, right? So I was socialized to the 2x2 box, right? You kind of fit everything into a 2x2 grid, right? And there's two kinds of possibilities, and and you make it fit, and there's an imperative to making it fit. And I think one thing social psychological stuff does is you don't have to make it fit, because we're messy and we're complicated and we're hypocritical and all those kinds of things. So it's kind of liberating in that way. And then again, it's a little bit hackish, but there's these mechanisms that I find, when I read Freud and I read Anna Freud and I read this stuff, these mechanisms, they harmonize with, the mechanisms that Barnett and Fenimore talked about in their book on pathologies. They have all sorts of ways in which bureaucratic structures impede the efficient use of information. They never really developed that as much as they could. I once talked to Michael Barnett. I actually asked him, this is really interesting. You all know Michael Barnett, right? And so he, Martha Fenimore and Catherine Sinking wrote the norm cascade model, right? And talked about how norms assume a life on their own and persist forever, right? And Martha Fenimore and Michael Barnett wrote the Pathologies of Institutions book. And that's all about how institutions break down and become incoherent, right? And so, being a theory geek, I went to Michael Barnett and I'm like, you're inconsistent, man. You're saying, or Martha Fenimore, I'm sorry, is inconsistent. You work with her, because on the one hand, you've got an argument that Fenimore is making, that things are set it and forget it, and on the other hand, she's got this pathologies argument. So I asked Barnett, what, can you explain that to me? And I thought it was really neat. He said, well, what I'm really interested in is tragedy. he's really interested in this isn't Fenimore talking, but it's he's really interested in hubris, right, and tragedy. And that's how he can flip from the kind of, working with Fenimore in the context of the norm cascade, and then flip to, working with Fenimore, even work with Fenimore in the norm cascade, but then, Fenimore can be working on the norm cascade, and Fenimore can also work with Barnett, and Barnett didn't see it as much of a problem because he was thinking in terms of tragedy, and then you're talking about the kind of flaws of the individual and what makes you great. I mean, how far are we from Shakespeare, Stratford upon, but what makes you great is what brings about your downfall. So that's the kind of, boy, I'm feeling really pretentious now. You're bringing in Shakespeare. But, since we're not that far. But I guess that's a long, what do you get out of these kinds of social psychological perspectives is it doesn't have to be linear. It doesn't have to add up. You can have hubris and these mechanisms where things go off the rails. And you're thinking more with a humanities model sometimes than a social sciences model. So that's the advantage, and maybe a way to go about thinking about it.
Thanks, Wes, that was really interesting. I'm just gonna ask a question about, you've got kind of three sort of stages, I guess, of your sort of construction, where it starts with construction, and then was it?
Conversion.
Conversion, and then crisis, and I guess that's sort of, goes back around in your model. My question's around the first stage, that kind of construction of this new thing, and I suppose I just wanted to know a bit more about what's actually going on at that stage in a way, and you talk about the fast thinking, slow thinking kind of that shift. Do you see that stage as because you talk about paradigms, is that a kind of a paradigmatic break where, in the sort of blind sense of night in uncertainty, and then new ideas emerge in which actors kind of construct a new paradigm. And if so, how do you see the concept of Martin Kushner speaks about like bricolage and, you know, the kind of piecing together of ideational institutional realities in order to kind of build something pragmatic. Like, do you see it as a more paradigmatic break, or do you see it as a kind of a more pragmatic kind of piecing together of existing ideas and so on?
Thanks. I mean, the model is different from Marx. The first part is similar to Marx, because Marx's equation, I call it the first half of Marx's equation, is that ideas reduce uncertainty and enable stability, right? And then stability continues. But what Marx needs, and it's on the footnote and on a page of Great Transformation, so he's aware of it, he cites Minsky. So he's aware of stability causes instability, but you only do so much in the book, and I think Marx is fantastic. The second half of the equation that he doesn't develop in the book is that ideas that reduce uncertainty can later become a source of misplaced certainty, and that causes instability, right? If you have misplaced certainty, so it reduces uncertainty initially and enables stability, but then later on, ideas are a source of misplaced certainty that causes stability. So that's where I'm different from Marx, or extended into a different part of the story than Marx. And so likewise, in disaggregating the moment of crisis, Marx writing at a very big scale, and again, it's great stuff. You know, the crises are often a kind of, bolt out of the blue, and it's very defined. But again, as we said on the last slide, these crises are 20 years long, right? And there are micro dynamics within the macro crises, right? Where you have fast thinking reactions, you have, pragmatic refinements, you come back around. I mean, the whole story of, FDR in the context of the Great Depression, you've got the first New Deal, he tries to balance the budget, that doesn't work. You've got the second New Deal, right? There's almost a fast, slow, fast again kind of dynamic. So there's a kind of space in there for pulling apart the moment of the crisis that I think a cognitive approach saying that, an event causes uncertainty and we come up with new cognitive ideas, you eventually do get there, but it's much messier in the kind of moment of crisis where, again, these crises can be 15, 20 years. But we think about them as these short, sharp shocks. With Martin, and again, I think Martin's fantastic, I'd say my emphasis is, my approach would just be that I like the bricolage kind of metaphor, but I'd put acid in the bricks. I'd say that it's not just a shaky structure, but the structure can, something in there can kind of corrode and bring the whole structure down, if we take a metaphor. I haven't read enough of Martin's stuff about, characterizing it completely, so I think I look a little bit more at the ways in which the pieces of the wall can kind of bring the wall down. There's an endogenous mechanism of order decay.
Thank you.
Can I just ask a really quick one, and then if there are no more, we'll dash to the airport. But it just struck me that some of this is we can't help how we think, and some of it maybe is we are strategic in how we think. So it just occurs to me that some of the particularly presidential characters that you've been describing are maybe more strategically appealing to the psychological aspect of who they think their audience is, whereas then actors in other maybe departments of government or treasury or wherever it is are maybe not allowed for that and need to be more technocratic, or maybe instinctively are in that job because they are more technocratic, they have a different kind of psychology. So I just didn't know if there was some sort of psychological explanations of what you're more prone to and what kind of job you might end up in and sort of that kind of thing.
I think that's spot on. I think there's, when I developed the model of Greater Mind in the book, it's that there's a kind of institutional shift at the moment of crisis, and this is Vivian too. There's the kind of focus on the communicative role of, in the American context, the rhetorical president, right? Once a problem is solved in terms of what Bergamot would call the social distribution of knowledge,
you know, the president doesn't focus on everything in the country constantly, then you shift in the social distribution of knowledge to people with expert authority and cognitive you know, causal expertise in the causal model. So it at the societal level, the thinking fast and slow, the president is the amygdala, and the treasury is the prefrontal cortex, right? And there's this kind of shift that happens. But it's not necessarily the personalities, right? It's to some extent, you know, that there's these kinds of roles. And the framers of the American Constitution didn't like a rhetorical president. They actually argued the president shouldn't engage in speech with the public because that would be a source of demagoguery. And boys, were they right. But it's the wasn't always that the president was the source of demagoguery, but since Woodrow Wilson, it kind of is, and Teddy Roosevelt kind of is. And it's a function of, I guess, the social distribution of knowledge as much as the personalities of the people.
Any more for you all? If not, then please join me in saying